This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. And a reminder, Layla Mudin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist, is available for consultations. One of the advantages of working with her is that you needn't come to New York to participate in care at the Hoffman Center. You can communicate with her telephonically and share your medical records with her, and she will provide you with some of the perspective that we offer, our intelligent medicine approach to your health problem. So check out drhoffman.com to find out how you can become a patient at the Hoffman Center. Of course, you're welcome to come and see me, but that involves a more traditional doctor's visit where you have to come physically to the office and be evaluated. All right. So what's our next question, please?
Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, with concerns about decreasing food sensitivities and allergies, how is one to know how much of an even healthy food to eat or not eat? For instance, I have a half an avocado, oils such as extra virgin coconut oil and olive oil, and other foods and ingredients daily. Is that too much? Am I at risk of developing a sensitivity or an allergy?
I'll let you handle that, and then maybe I'll chime in, okay?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. If you've already eliminated foods that you know you're sensitive and allergic to, it will allow your immune system to calm down. It would be quite rare, if you weren't eating avocado before and you're having avocado and you're having good foods like extra virgin olive oil, coconut oil, and things like that, it would be quite rare for you to develop a sensitivity to it. However, having said that, this is nature's argument for variety in the diet, because it appears that the foods that we eat most frequently are the ones that over time our immune system can start to have a problem with. Let me give an example. I remember a client, this was has to be about 10 years ago, we told her she had to go on a gluten-free diet, and she did it very well. Well, about a year later, we found out she developed an allergy to rice. Well, rice is ubiquitous in a gluten-free diet. A lot of gluten-free breads and products like pasta are made from rice. So she was basically having rice all day long. Could be a little extreme intake of rice that might have prompted this? It's a good question.
Yeah. So,
what do you think, Dr. Hoffman?
Well, what I think is that there's certain foods, there's sort of a hierarchy of foods that you can be allergic to. And
yeah.
The foods that you're most likely to be allergic to are generally in the grain family, certain fruits, nuts,
yeah.
Dairy products, shellfish in some cases, and fish in general. And, so...
nuts and tree nuts, yep.
So less likely tree that you're going to be allergic nuts. To coconut or avocado, you know. And, you know, one of the principles of... the rotation diet, you know, which is kind of an old principle in what used to be called clinical ecology, environmental medicine, is that you know, if you're a very allergic person, is that you rotate foods. You don't harp on one food day in, day out, you know, have it all the time, because an allergic person may form an allergy to food that they eat frequently. Now, I'm not going to ram that point home, because sometimes, you know, you become a little too orthorexic about that. You know, the term reflects shall we say, over-the-top obsession with what you're eating, which may or may not be warranted. You know, if you're not that allergic, in principle, it shouldn't matter. You know, and then, you know, you just get kind of carried away with this rather arduous process of, you know, rotating your foods, charting them, screening, you know, what you're eating, and thinking about
obsessing
it too many
about
hours.
Eating correctly all the time.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So
that's a soul killer right there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm going to compliment you. And one of the nice things about you is that you're very conscious of eating carefully. But you're not like a puritanical kind of person when it comes to eating. And so I think you impart good attitudes towards foods. You recognize that for some people, they have to do some real tough work to hone appropriate diet for themselves. But you don't take some great joy in cramping people's eating style, you know, or being the food police. I mean, it's not a role that you relish. So,
and you know, if there's something the phrase I use a lot around here is, I am not the food police. I am here to support you in your feeling better, whatever that entails. If that entails you're going to eliminate a few foods, I'm going to find you some decent substitutes that you're going to be happy with, or I'm not doing my job. And the other thing is, some people have to be very rigid. I'm talking about, say, somebody with celiac disease. They can't have a nanogram of gluten.
Right.
But there are other people who just kind of have to swing between that 80% of the time they're doing the right thing. And that's fine, and that's what could work for them. Because when we then become too rigid, or we say, you can never eat that again, or I look like the food police to somebody, all I'm going to get back is resentment and anger. And I'm not doing this.
Right, right.
Throw the whole program out the window. Nobody was interested, I say this a lot too, nobody was interested in the cookie jar that sat on the kitchen counter for 30 years until somebody came along and said, never again. Now suddenly, hey, I wasn't interested in cookies before. Now I'm obsessed because you said never to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole psychology.
Very well
said. We should be psychology minors as nutritionists, honestly.
Yeah, you know.
Because it's a behavior. Eating is a behavior.
It, you know, consciously or unconsciously, we're applying psychology all the time in this field. So,
yeah.
You know, whether or not you, you know, acknowledge it or whether you've got a PhD in psychology, to be an effective health practitioner, you really have to engage in psychological techniques and with a psychological insight as to, you know, how that's going to affect the patient. All right, let's move on to our next question.
Yes, Aaron, thank you for that very thoughtful question. Our next question comes from Gladys. She asks, can taking collagen powder, bone powder, and strontium help fill in the hip holes of an aged postmenopausal woman who's afraid of hip fractures?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my.
Yeah,
Fill in the hip holes, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what she means by hip holes. I mean, unless she's
being...
Well,
maybe osteoporotic bone.
Right, right. Yeah,
is
I guess
what I visualize. You know,
I mean,
Swiss
hope
cheese.
She doesn't. Yeah, I hope she doesn't really have literally hip holes, you know, on X-ray or on imaging studies. Hopefully what she's referring to is just run-of-the-mill osteoporosis. There are conditions where literally there are holes in the bone. These are extreme pathological conditions, you know, osteogenesis imperfecta and various kinds of conditions where literally they can be like Swiss cheese holes in the bones. But, you know, if we're talking about osteoporosis, yeah, you know, strontium's good. Is collagen powder good? Maybe there's a role for collagen powder, hyaluronic acid. I'm not sure. It's not one of the things that I really insist upon with our patients. What else do we do for bone?
Vitamin C can boost collagen.
Yes.
It's so that might be a way.
Boosting the production, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We like Ostanol. We like Ostanol. We like Ostera to help slow the turnover of rapid bone turnover, which is happening in osteoporosis. But I think Ostanol is one of the things I'm most excited about.
Yeah,
making sure that vitamin D levels are within range, making sure that you're getting enough magnesium, doing weight-bearing exercise. This is extremely important. I think especially as we get older as women, you have to do more strength training if you were not before. And there are two simple exercises to doing that for your lower body. It's doing a lot of squats, and it's doing a lot of lunges.
Right. We also
either with weights or just the weight of your own body, and do it to fatigue 3 days a week with a day off in between.
This sounds
so
like something
that can help with bone health.
Sounds like something you're doing yourself.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I find, if I may stray just a little bit, Dr. Hoppin, We have some patients who just never exercised, hate exercise. Their eyes glaze over when I bring up the topic of exercise, but I make a deal with them. And for the lower body, it's those two exercises, lunges and squats. And for the upper body, it's doing push-ups. And I say to them, I make a deal with them. I say, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning, you're going to do these three exercises, two for the lower body, one for the upper, and you're going to do it to fatigue. This does not require a gym membership. This does not require you go out and buy athletic wear. This does not require you have a meal before you do these exercises. You do not even need a pair of sneakers. Just bounce out of bed Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Do these exercises to fatigue, and that's all I will require of them. And it might take only 5 to 7 to 10 minutes, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. That's not a lot of commitment.
Absolutely.
Some people get excited about it because it's only that little amount of time, because when you first start doing these weight-bearing exercises, you're going to be fatigued very quickly, very easily, until you get up to around you're doing this for 20 or even 30 minutes.
Right. I think it's about consistency, also something they can stick to.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, until we can get them excited about, you know, going to a gym or becoming a runner or joining a sports team,
yeah,
which would be ideal because that's a lot of fun,
yeah,
then it's called leisure activity, which
right.
is wonderful.
Well, that's not for everyone, you know. Unfortunately. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so, and then, of course, do we mention vitamin K as part of that regimen as well?
Oh, vitamin K, very, yeah. very important.
Mentioned it in the last broadcast as a means of enhancing, preventing cardiovascular disease. It also enhances bone. Okay.
Right. And Gladys, get your DHEA checked. It's a blood test called DHEA sulfate. It goes down as we get older. You want good levels for your age. And if it's lower, it's often appropriate to take a DHEA supplement.
Indeed. That's important. And
yeah.
for men, we look at testosterone because that can be part of the equation. Right. Good.
Yeah. Thank you, Gladys, for your question.
Okay. Our next question.
Dr. Hopp, yeah, we've got an email from Bulgaria.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Hello, Dr. Hoffman. We are from Bulgaria. Here is our story. 4 years ago, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. She did chemotherapy. The doctor said, you're looking okay, but then last year the cancer returned. It's now in her lymph nodes in her neck, and it's spread to her thyroid gland. Do you think IV vitamin C will help her at this point? She is stage 4.
Yeah, I think, look, you know, this is a very tough kind of problem to tackle. And,
yeah.
you know, it sounds like, in spite of the fact that, you know, probably the healthcare in Bulgaria is variable, it sounds like this person's mother is being exposed to, you know, the whatever benefits are to be had from a Western style of therapy. So far, that hasn't panned out.
Yeah.
So intravenous vitamin C, yes. I don't think it's a cancer panacea. I don't think just administering that is going to make a complex cancer problem disappear. But it wouldn't hurt, and it might help. Mm-hmm. And my experience is that many patients with even stage 4 advanced cancer live longer, experience better quality of life, and it could be part of the plan. Now, who's going to administer that in Bulgaria? Maybe there are practitioners who are familiar with that. Certainly in other countries in Western Europe, in Germany, France, England, there are practitioners who are familiar with that. Italy, perhaps, too. So, you know, if you want to see if that could be beneficial, I would encourage you to look into it. And, you know, we've done programs on the current research on intravenous vitamin C. Most of it is being, you know, we've been doing it for a long time for cancer. Much of the research is centering around Dr. Jeannie Drisco at the Kansas University Medical Center, where mm-hmm. she's administering that under a research grant. And in full view and with full cooperation of the mainstream oncologists there, and typically patients will get sometimes chemotherapy in the morning and then walk over to get their intravenous vitamin C in the afternoon. There's real cooperation between the mainstream docs and the integrative center at that medical center in Kansas City. So mm-hmm. Here's Middle America that's taking the lead in intravenous vitamin C research. And I think it really is something there. question is, you know, how what cancers respond best? What is the best dose? How long does one have to get treatment? How frequent should the treatments be? These are all things that need to be further worked out. But, you know, we do it.
Yeah.
And we have several cancer patients who are really benefiting.
Yeah. Oh, best of luck to your mother.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, this email came from Ivka. Ivka, best of luck to your mother, Ivka.
And if nothing else, right, it's very gratifying to hear that we have such a vast outreach and that people are following us in far-flung parts of the world, like Bulgaria. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. That's exciting. We've got a question from Paul. What is your opinion of fluoride in water, toothpaste, and mouthwash? Do you, Dr. Hoffman or Layla, use any products with fluoride?
I stay away. I mean, I look for fluoride-free toothpaste. The brand I use is the Spry Dental Defense System from one of our sponsors, Clear, X-L-E-A-R, because it is xylitol, which inhibits strep mutans, which is responsible for dental plaque and decay.
Mm-hmm.
So we prefer, you know, you get plenty of fluoride from other sources. It's in the water. It's in many food products.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, because, it, you know, ultimately we probably get too much. It's toxic. Yes, it protects teeth, but at what cost? And then there's the issue of, you know, if you take too much, it actually has a boomerang effect, and it may damage the surface of teeth, causing mottling of the surface of teeth.
Fluorosis,
called dental fluorosis.
Fluorosis. And fluoride also competes with iodine, does it not? For take by the thyroid. Fluoride is also not good in excess for bone health. And I wonder if there's any correlation with osteoporosis in this country. And the other thing, if I may mention about mouthwash, one of the problems with mouthwash is the alcohol content in mouthwash. That alcohol is causing your mouth to dry out, and it's also destroying your microbiome, your beneficial bacteria in your mouth.
Right.
That may be resisting the strep mutans.
Mm-hmm. So there are definitely problems with fluoride, and, you know, this is a highly debated issue, but I've come down on the side of, you know, let's see if we can get the fluoride out of our water supply, use water filters
definitely,
if you're in a place where they do that, and, you know, try to minimize your exposure to fluoride by opting for fluoride-free toothpaste. I really think it's overrated as a dental protective.
I do have a confession to make, but it's only because I am so far in my 50s and blessed with not a cavity, nothing. My gum health is excellent, and all I've been buying is AIM toothpaste because it's only 99 cents.
With fluoride in it.
With fluoride in it.
It has fluoride.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
it has fluoride, yeah.
So maybe you're a poster girl for fluoride, or maybe not. Who knows?
Maybe not. But there's no microparticles in AIM toothpaste. So. Oh,
okay. All right.
All right. Paul, thank you for your question.
Okay. And we have time for what? Is there such a thing as a quick question on our roster of questions today?
Yeah. All right. Let's see here. Okay. We've got another question here. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Is it okay to supplement with magnesium even without blood levels showing a deficiency? And is there advantage of transdermal magnesium over oral in terms of absorption?
Okay, so the question is, if you don't see a deficiency in magnesium, the tests are not very accurate for detecting deficiency in magnesium. So therefore, we use special tests. We use not, you know, the basic test is a serum magnesium. That's not going to be low unless you're really in trouble. We use ionized magnesium, which is a much more sensitive test. You could also use red blood cell magnesium, which sometimes mirrors the accuracy of ionized magnesium. And can anyone benefit from magnesium supplementation? I think since 70% of people have either magnesium deficiency, outright magnesium deficiency, or magnesium insufficiency, I think that magnesium should be, you know, among the top five nutrients that people take. You know, if we're going to say what are the top five, you know, maybe vitamin C and fish oil and a probiotic, vitamin D and magnesium. These are among the most important nutrients that we could consider taking, even if we don't take other things.
Yeah, yeah.
So what other parts of the question were there? There was like what type is best?
Yeah, what type? Transdermal over oral?
Yeah, I'm not sure the transdermal really works. Some studies say that it does get absorbed through the skin. I think Epsom salt baths, there's some absorption. But
I think there's magnesium spray and magnesium cream.
Right. And we use several forms of magnesium. We use something called protosorb magnesium. We want magnesium to get to the brain for anxiety. Mm-hmm. We use the jigsaw for
magnesium
general
belly
supplementation. We use magnesium taurate for the heart. We use magnesium glycinate sometimes when we don't want to get diarrhea. And when we want to promote bowel movements, we use magnesium citrate.
Yeah. Five types of magnesium.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And intravenous magnesium, of course, for people who really are tired, have chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, migraines.
Yeah. Muscle aches.
Yeah, that can be a real pick-me-up for those types. And even sometimes for bad menopausal symptoms, it has a mood effect, it's a calmative effect. So that's the so-called Myers cocktail that's rich in magnesium. All right, so that's all the time that we have for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. And we invite you to send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. We also invite you to shop for your supplement needs at the Hoffman Center store. That can be accessed via drhoffman.com at our Intelligent Medicine website. Just click on the store, and you can find a complete assortment of the supplements that we talk about on this program. We only feature the highest quality products at reasonable prices. And we have a price match guarantee. So for all your supplement needs, go to drhoffman.com. And also, thereby, you can help to support this program if you enjoy this free resource. Thanks for joining us today, Layla.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.